Welcome to another episode of Occupy Interview Radio. Your host today is going to be Mark Lahr, Terry Bain, and I'm James. Our guest today is Cliff Arnbeck. He's an attorney here in Ohio. He's been fighting election fraud and other activities here in the great United States for some years. Why don't you say hello, Cliff?
Howdy.
How are you doing today, sir?
I'm fine.
Cliff's on vacation, so we won't make this too long. All right, let's start off the show with, you know, one of my big stories and things I've talked to you about in the past, Cliff, has been the Michael Connell story. Could you give us a quick summary of what that's all about and where we are currently in that story?
Mike Connell was an IT expert for Karl Rove, beginning all the way back through 1988. And he was involved in just about any project that Karl Rove thought important. He would make sure that Mike Connell would be heading the web design and the internet applications of that project. So on July 17th of 2008, we held a news conference in Columbus, Ohio, in which we included a guy named Stephen Spoonamore, who was a friend and colleague of Mike Connell's. And Spoonamore had been having discussions with Connell about coming forward to the United States Congress and to the Justice Department to talk about the vulnerability of our election system in the United States to electronic and fraudulent manipulation. And we have not been successful in getting an interview set up with Congress, and we, on July 17th, we announced that we were planning to file a racketeering claim against Rove as the principal perpetrator in an ongoing scheme of election manipulation in the United States. And we identified Mike Connell as the key witness in that case. And within two or three days, there was an anonymous tip coming in that saying that the tipster was associated with the McCain for President campaign, and that he wanted to inform us of a threat by Karl Rove against Mike Connell, and also to inform us that the base of operations for this election stealing operation was in Enterprise, Alabama. And those tips continued. Stephen Spoonamore made some calls and within the Republican Party and reported to me that he believed that there was, in fact, a threat against Mike Connell. I informed the authorities, state and federal, of that. And things went along. There continued to be tips. There continued to be efforts to communicate with Connell and bring him into the system. Ultimately, we succeeded in getting a federal court to order his appearance for a deposition. We took his deposition on the day before the election in 2008. And about 6 weeks later, his plane was returning from Washington, D.C. to his home airport in Akron and crashed. And it was he was a solo pilot. It was his plane, but it was a crash in suspicious circumstances. So then there was some investigations going on. Then in September of 2009, another person, or possibly the same person who had originally given us the tip about threats against Connell's life, a person identifying himself as Mark Felt, the tipster in the informant in Deep Throat of Watergate fame, saying that describing the circumstances of how Mike Connell's plane had been tampered with in order to the navigation system had been tampered with in order to cause his plane to crash. There have been discussions from time to time with the FBI about this, and we continue to seek a FBI and Justice Department investigation and further investigation and prosecution related to all of this. We don't know if they are picking up on it or not, but we continue to keep them informed, and we continue to press forward to the best of our ability to litigate privately in a racketeering case that we have advised the state of Ohio that we'll be filing before this next election to litigate the ongoing election theft by Karl Rove. Yes.
Excuse me, Cliff. Is there any question that this man, Michael Connell, was assassinated at this point?
Well, there are people who would say that yes, there is a question because the National Transportation Safety Board does an investigation, and my understanding is that their jurisdiction is limited to identifying non-criminal causes for a crash.
Correct. I believe so.
So their investigation is really, they don't have jurisdiction to say it appears that this was a criminal cause. So they said that there were adverse weather conditions, and that's their official report, that he took off from Washington, College Park, Maryland, knowing that there wasn't perfect flying conditions, and there was some cold weather
very reminiscent of the Paul Wellstone, Senator Paul Wellstone crash too, because you know there's all kinds of conflict. You know, there, you know, people went back and looked at the weather data, and there was no ice, but that was on the NTSB report that it was icing that day and other weather problems. So I don't think they can be trusted. You know, here's a question that leads into it. Why, when the Obama administration came into power, did they not go and investigate all these crimes of the 8 years before? I mean, do you have an idea on that? Or is there progress being made on, you know, say, you know, some of this election rigging or, you know, 2004 and beyond?
Well, that's a good question. You know, part of the answer, I think, is that the government, and Obama referred to this at the outset, that the government is this massive operation, and it takes time to turn things around. So the Justice Department is a substantial institution responsible for prosecuting crime, but the Justice Department has been corrupted for a long time, and this is documented in the book by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow, in which she documents that since the Nixon administration and the war on drugs, we have had a program which was really designed to target inner city African American males for incarceration and for the purpose of disrupting the African American community and families, and causing interfering with their exercise of voting and so on. So that's been going on for some time. And in the Bush administration, Karl Rove was doing a masterful job of stacking the Justice Department in its civil service part of it, with people who were selected on the basis of loyalty to President Bush and Rove. So this was admitted to at before the end of the Bush administration, and Mukasey, when he took the position as new Attorney General, substituting for Alberto Gonzalez, pledged to correct the situation, but he did not pledge to purge the civil service part of the Justice Department of lawyers who were really not qualified, but who had been selected on the basis of their partisan affiliation or loyalty. So this is a problem, and it's illustrated in a very important example of the prosecution of Governor Don Siegelman in Alabama.
That took
place as a means of preventing him from running again for governor of Alabama after his 2002 election had been stolen. They wanted to incapacitate his ability to run again. They prosecuted him. There was an attorney in Alabama who came forward. This was a former top operative for Karl Rove, changed sides in 2007 and came forward in an affidavit and in testimony before the House Judiciary Committee and explained how Karl Rove had used the Justice Department to initiate the prosecution and how they had arranged for a partisan and corrupt federal judge to get the case who would go after Siegelman. So all of this came out. It was on 60 Minutes and so on, and had quite a bit of public attention, including from more than 50 former state attorneys general from around the country, arguing that that prosecution was partisan and it should be discontinued. But nevertheless, the Obama administration continued to press forward with that prosecution. And that's a example of something that's very hard to reconcile with an administration that wants to clean up the mess that Karl Rove created during his time in the White House.
Now, I have one follow-up question. What can we do about a government that is in charge of policing itself? Do you have any ideas and solutions that we could, you know, to root out this problem of conflict of interest, you know, with the government constantly having to bury its own secrets?
Well, what can we do about it? We've had a problem for some time, and after the assassination of John Kennedy, President Truman wrote a letter to the Washington Post urging that the executive order that he signed, which established covert activities as part of the agenda for the CIA, should be rescinded or reversed. There have been investigations of criminal activity by the United States government, which is covered up on the basis that national security justifies the use of criminal methods to protect the national security. There have been investigations of this. There have been actions taken against this, but you know, this continues to be something which is part of our governmental process. And I would argue that it really has no place in a democratic government, a constitutional government. It needs to be stopped.
Okay, let's move over to Terry. Do you have any questions, or Mark?
I've got a question here. I was kind
go
of
ahead,
I'm out of practice on this story. I remember it, but vaguely. But I didn't remember a connection to Mark Felt / Deep Throat. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Sure. It was September 2009, And the letter was very brief. It said enclosed is a document that is not supposed to exist. Mike Connell was not a national security threat. And signed Mark Felt. We know it was not Mark Felt because Mark Felt died, I think it was the day before Mike Connell's airplane crash. So we know it's a pseudonym. And the attachment was what would appear to be an after-action report with various names redacted. But it basically said it was dated December 19th, written at about eight something in the morning of December 19th. It talked about receiving a call. I think it was in the early morning to 2 o'clock or something, going to terminate a national security threat. Gave the call letters to the airplane, the location of the airplane at the College Park Airport. Said that they proceeded to the airport. It was a team of people. They surveilled to determine that there was not security in place. They approached the plane. They entered the plane. They affixed a device that they referred to it as an AMD device. I don't know what that is. They sanitized the cockpit, exited the plane, exited the premises, and the report was being prepared at 8:30 that morning. And we had a guy who was former National Security Agency person look at the letter, and he said he thought there were a lot of things about it which led him to believe it was authentic. And the way I look at it is that somebody was preparing that to show that they believe they were acting in good faith based upon a instruction from people who are authorized to give such instructions. And that's the reason for the letter, the document, that the person doing this assassination was documenting the fact that he believed he'd received instructions to terminate Connell's life based upon from instructions from a person authorized to issue such instructions.
Thank you. That's fascinating.
Go ahead,
James.
I was going to say, I'm surprised they didn't send a drone out in Ohio to take him out. Go ahead, Mark.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the way the investigation was carried out by the NTSB. I understand that it was a little bit on the unusual side, and I believe there's the whole thing with the missing BlackBerry, which may have had a lot of information on Rove and Bush.
Yes, there are a lot of strange things in connection with the investigation. There was a reporter, investigator, acting on a private basis who went up after the crash, went to Akron, named Kyle Hentz, and he prepared a report of his what he found when he went up there. And there were a number of surprising things. One was the statement by I think it was the fire chief, a first responder, who said that when he called the tower, the air control tower, and asked how many souls were on board, he was told that there was a lockdown on information, and he expressed a great puzzlement as to how why that would be the case, because the responsibility of the first responder, the fire people, would be to try to save anybody's life that might have if somebody might have been thrown free or might be lying out there and possibly could be saved, they need to know how many bodies they're looking for. So that was one surprising thing. Another surprising thing is that the understanding was that it's a plane crash, they normally would cordon off the area, and they would do their investigation or careful review of the whole scene in daylight hours in order to have do a better job. This was done before midnight. They took everything away and they took it to a hangar owned by I think Lockheed Corporation, and so that seemed strange. It was the wife, Heather Connell, who was the one that expressed great frustration that when she went to the scene on December 20, it was a Saturday, I forget whether it's 2020, whatever, it was a Saturday. I went to the scene on a Sunday, and she was there the day before. I think it may have been December 26th, and found body parts or brain matter of her husband. And then when the personal effects were given to her, it had his computer, but it didn't have his BlackBerry, and they knew that he always carried his BlackBerry, and they were very disturbed that that wasn't there. There was also in the pictures, the TV footage on the night of the crash, there were a couple of guys dressed in appearing to be dressed as Civil Air Patrol people, and I guess they had identified themselves as Civil Air Patrol, acting on instructions from Alabama, which is the headquarters of the Civil Air Patrol. But then there was someone in charge of the local Civil Air Patrol who said that those people were not Civil Air Patrol. So there were a lot of puzzling things about the aftermath of that. And the two guys, supposedly Civil Air Patrol people, said that they were looking for the thing that keeps sending a signal, a tracking signal.
Right.
And there was speculation that they might have been looking for the device that that had been placed to alter the navigation capability of the airplane, or something else, or the BlackBerry, whatever.
Would that possibly refer to the three-letter abbreviation that was referred to earlier in the letter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, James.
I was going to say we should get back on election integrity and occupy the ballot box. You know, what kind of things can we do, Cliff, to make sure we have a real election this time?
Well, you know, that's the great question, and it's what's amazing is that there are so many things that could have been done before now. To help have honest elections, which have not been done. And we've done many things that actually facilitate fraudulent elections, starting with the Help America Vote Act, where we spent billions of dollars to move toward electronic voting technology, which the experts in the field say has not been perfected or developed to the point where it's suitable for an auditable, non-hackable election. and yet that's what we have. So we even have election voting machines, some voting machines that don't even have the a token appearance of being auditable because they have no paper trail whatsoever. So all you have is an electronic data that can easily be hacked. And I can't tell you all those states, but Georgia is one that jumps out in my mind. They don't have any kind of they have electronic voting machines, DRE voting machines with no paper trail whatsoever.
James, I've got a question here.
Go ahead.
I didn't know whether our guest had worked with Bev Harris yet. We're going to try and get her on the show to see what her take on what can the Occupy movement do to try to bring voter integrity back. Because of the large size of this movement, it would be nice if people had a better idea of what they could be doing to try to bring voter integrity back. Do you think she's on track with what she's been working on in black box voting?
Yes. Bev has been on this and has really done more to popularize the understanding of the vulnerability of electronic voting technology to manipulation, probably more than anyone else in the country. You know, the in Ohio and California in 2007, we had two Democratic secretaries of state who conducted their own technological studies utilizing the very best experts in the field, and the conclusion of both studies was that these DRE machines are not can't be relied upon. And in the case of California, the Secretary of State decertified the DRE machines, and they rely on a system of optical scan paper ballots, and I think their voting, the integrity of their voting has improved as a consequence of that. In Ohio, the Secretary of State recommended that action, but because of the monetary, the economic implications of it, she said that the decision to do that should be the governor and the legislature, not hers. So the governor and the legislature did not change the system. So in Ohio, we still have
that's a cop out.
Yeah, we still have a combination of DRE machines with a paper trail and optical scan voting technology.
Cliff, did you catch that Ireland scrapped all their electronic voting machines? Literally, send them to the scrapyard.
Yep.
It's this week. I saw that recently. It's good news. Although, that, you know, is it possible to do paper ballots? You think we could get away with that? You know, just like
now,
the good old days?
This was one of the things that the Secretary of State of Ohio insisted that there be a paper ballot option to the voter. And the problem with that is that most people, they don't understand the problem. You know, why would there be voting technology that's susceptible to fraud? So when they go in, they think, oh, it's very nice to be able to touch the screen and vote that way. It seems so simple and easy. Rather than asking for a paper ballot, you're supposed to have the right to ask for a paper ballot in Ohio. Not many people do. When I did the last election, they acted like, you know, it was something strange, and they had great difficulty finding the paper ballot. They said, oh, you want to vote provisionally? I said, no, I'm a fully qualified voter. I have a right to vote. I want to vote on a paper ballot. And ultimately I was able to, but it was not an easy task. So the problem is that most people just don't understand. I can't believe that the government would be giving them a technology by which to vote that is susceptible to massive fraud.
We have a question from the chat room. Okay, from our live listener. Thank you for showing up, everybody. We appreciate it. Tell your friends and loved ones. Okay, our first question, a little more on topic here, is do you believe that this next election is going to be fraud-free? I mean, or are we going to expect to see all kinds of problems, I guess the question is.
Yeah. Well, I believe that we are at a crossroads, as Karl Rove likes to say. The question is, will the government of this country or the people take the steps necessary to block the fraud? And the fraud is going on already in a number of different ways. And one of the biggest ways is all this secretly funded advertising designed to, propaganda, defamatory propaganda against Democratic candidates in very large volume, even this far out before the election. There's an effort being made to scandalize candidates such as Sherrod Brown in the United States Senate, the President Obama, and to do it in such a volume that people believe the lie, and it's very difficult to come up with the money when you're being when the other side's being funded by secret corporate money. Corporations are corporations, and people don't, it's not like Scalia said that most corporations are just mom and pop operations. The corporations
right.
that are buying the election are in many cases have budgets larger than some of the countries of the world. They have billions and billions of dollars, and they are trying to fraudulently manipulate public opinion to affect this election, so that the candidates who are elected are those who will be responsive to the so-called 1%. It's actually, 0.0001%, rather than to the majority of people.
Okay, another question from the chat room. The guy is asking if we should be concerned about a false flag event. I'm sure you're aware of what that is. Something. To get the people rallying behind the government or the people that another party's agenda. Now, I know a lot of people were really concerned when the last Bush election that he was going to find some reason to declare martial law or something along those lines to hold back the elections. Should we be concerned about any of that coming up soon with the Obama administration? Not saying so much that Obama, but people in power that may want to like where they're at and don't want to give up power. Should we be concerned about some sort of hinky thing happening before the election?
Well, the false flag operation that I would point to is the Depression, the American Depression. The Republicans are trying to put that flag on the Obama administration, that you've had 4 years and you haven't turned the economy around. The truth is, that the stimulus that Obama proposed and got, as limited as it was a helpful thing. There should be more. There should be revenue sharing going to the states and local governments so that public employees wouldn't be getting laid off, which greatly contributes to the recession or depression. And so this is the false flag operation of this election. Paul Krugman, who's probably our most distinguished economist in the world today, has made it very clear in his book called End the Depression Now that there are simple, well-proven Keynesian economic steps that can be taken, such as revenue sharing and infrastructure improvements, et cetera, that we have it's as easy as making a pie, and yet it's being blocked by people who say we have to have we have to focus on reducing the deficit and use austerity measures to do so. That is all it's all a fraud, and it is the pinning the depression on Obama is nothing more than a false flag operation to make people believe that we've got to have another guy to give him a chance to do something about
Interesting.
It.
Mm-hmm. Terry, why don't you go next?
Yeah, I just had a is anyone the question's been raised by the Ron Paul campaign, that the vote fraud, vote rigging, there seems to already be evidence beginning to show up that the vote fraud is happening. Not is it going to happen for the general election, but it's already happening in the primary elections. So it doesn't seem to be confined to the standard paradigm of left wing, right wing, or Democrat, Republican. And the kids in Occupy seem to be well aware that this is not a party thing. Do you have any response to them? Because they feel like they've totally been sold out the river here.
Well, I think that's true. I think the first major fraud in the election process that I'm aware of was in the 1988 primary in New Hampshire. And this followed George Herbert Walker Bush lost the Iowa caucuses. And at that point, Karl Rove, who was running the election campaign, said to Mike Connell and two other guys, we've got to get the evangelicals on our side, and we've got to get technology on our side. Pat Robertson, the evangelical minister, had beaten Bush, and Bob Dole had beaten Bush. So then we go to the New Hampshire primary in 1988, and Bush suddenly wins in contrary to what the pre-election polls and the exit polls showed for that election. It was a miraculous victory, and it was a computer-assisted victory. But that was the first example of the kind of very large-scale shifting of votes using computer technology in this record. And then the fraud then continues, and it's an interesting kind of fraud. It's not a steal as many votes as you need to win. It's a shifting of about 5% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
In each presidential election since 1988, so that in some cases the Democrat wins, like Bill Clinton and Obama, but the percentage of victory is less than the actual vote. So both Clinton and Obama were denied the mandate or the level of support that they actually received from the voters. And in the other elections, according to the exit polls, Dukakis won the 1988 election. Gore won the 2000 election. Kerry won the 2004 election. And these were not squeakers. These were by a significant margin.
Good point. So do you have a word of optimism for the audience? I mean, the hardest thing to try to get across to people is resistance is not futile. Do you see any good news out there?
Well, I see good news. There was a conference June 18th through the 20th in Washington, D.C. called Take Back the American Dream. And it had a wonderful group of speakers, and I found it quite exciting. Jesse Jackson talked about the Occupy movement is not in the past. It is it's going to be focused on occupying this coming election. He talked about Jesus as being an occupier and entering the temple to throw out the money changers.
Yep.
And he talked about Nelson Mandela as an occupier and Martin Luther King as an occupier. And he didn't outline his agenda, but it made it very clear that he wants to see that movement, the Occupy movement, occupy the 2012 election. Paul Krugman spoke, and it was very clear, it couldn't have been clearer, that this is an easy thing to correct the depression. So people who are trying to persuade people to vote for the Republican because the Democrat has been in office while this depression has continued, it's just a lie. And then the I introduced by way of questions to a couple of the panels the fact that we have a first-rate industrial mathematician who's documented this election, this pattern of election theft. And the word is out. I mean, this is not speculation. This is not, talk about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This is proof to an astronomical level of certainty that Roe's been stealing elections. So how in the world can we have... can we go into this election without having the FBI and the Justice Department saying, "Well, you know, we're going to be monitoring this. We're going to be looking at all the software being used in these computers in real time. We're going to be doing a oversight of this election and be prepared to intervene at any point where there's." Malicious code being inserted, I think that we, from everything I could sense of this meeting, where you had leaders in the Democratic Party, leaders from the major public interest groups all participating, it looked to me as though people are now ready to say, we're not going to let Karl Rove steal any more elections.
Mark Clark, did you want to jump in?
I just want to remind everybody that Cliff is the chair of the legal committee for Common Cause Ohio. I know Common Cause is a great group people can check into to get more information. And he's also the national co-chair and attorney for the Alliance for Democracy. So I wanted to go ahead and make sure he got those plugged in.
Well, at the time of the litigation in the 2004 election, I was at that time I was the in both of those positions. I'm no longer co-chair of the Alliance for Democracy. I'm still chair of the Legal Committee of the Ohio Common Cause.
Okay.
And then free Cliff, for information.
Like...
For information.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
About the news organization, and I think covers this issue the best of anyone in the country, is freepress.org. And that.
Yeah, do you have any other plugs or a book or anything you want to throw out there? Please do. Or any other links?
Well, I would suggest people go to Richard Charnin, Charnin, .com. And look at his material. This guy did the mathematical design work for the lunar module for Grumman Aerospace. He has worked on Wall Street. He's a person of preeminent qualifications as a mathematician. And since 2004, he has pretty much focused on nothing other than the mathematical modeling of the election process to establish exactly the rate of stealing that's going on, the rate of vote shifting and vote theft that's going on.
Okay, we have one more question from the chat room. I think it'll be the last one today. We have a group on our website, one of our social networks that we are affiliated with called 1260.info, and we also have Occupy America's social network. we have a group on that site that's called the No Confidence Party. And they are spearheading a program to say, you know, there's no difference between Obama and Romney. And that is our chat room question is, you know, why should we even bother? Because it doesn't seem like there is much of a difference between these two approved. And we have to put into this, I think, the media manipulation of the vote. You know, even, you know, throw aside all the rigging, you just have this, you know, constant bashing that there is no third party, there is no alternative. You have, these are your two parties, and go from there. Next comment, please.
Well, I think there is a difference between the two parties. The Republican Party has basically become the party, it's called Craig Unger's coming out with a book September 4th. It's called Boss Rove. It basically said that Rove has taken over the Republican Party by virtue of his control of over $1 billion in the spending on the election campaign. So the Republican Party has become totally subservient to the this elite, self-appointed elite that wants to control the politics of the country and the world and the economies. The Democratic Party, yeah.
Sorry to jump in. I should clarify that between Romney and Obama, there isn't a difference. Not so much the parties themselves. Let's just say that once they get in there, it's like, you know, they just continue each other's, you know, constitutional killing agenda, it seems like. You know, the more power to the executive, less to Congress, less to oversight, the power to make war, all these things. Let's just, if you could, just specifically on these two type of candidates that we have presented.
Well, I just don't think it's true that the Democratic Party and Obama have I just don't think it's true that there's not a difference. Obama would have gotten us out of this depression by now if he'd been if they'd accepted his leadership and he's not perfect, but he's better far better than the Republicans and anything Romney's doing. There are other things, this national security state, this military-industrial complex that exercises undue influence over any president of any party is obviously a serious problem. But that's not to say that there's not a difference. The Obama he may have a gun to his head. He may be misguided in some areas, but he's not totally subservient to the people, to Karl Rove, et cetera. So I just don't think it's
well,
about
the
difference.
The expansion of drone use.
I have great respect for Jill Stein of the Green Party. I've met her. I applaud her. I believe that the best thing that could happen for our the process would be for us to have a real focus on the debates among the candidates, whether it's for the presidency or the Senate or whatever. Real debates include the third party. Jill Stein is a highly intelligent person with wonderful ideas and so on, and just having her as part of the debate would create a genuine kind of dialogue, which would help facilitate getting an intelligent conversation going, an intelligent deliberation, and intelligent voting.
Doesn't that bring us back to the media, though, ignoring these other candidates that are really bringing in, at the very least, some good points into the discussion? Isn't the media really just let us down, in at least in that one regard?
Well, I think that if you look at the 2008 cycle in the presidential election and the primary period, both parties had open debates, and they had full slates. They had a lot of people up there, including people who would be very much independent, maverick-type candidates. And they were good debates. They were healthy for the process. And then we get to the general election, and it was a much narrower process. We've got the model of these open debates as a model to be used to have a real dialogue. And it could be done. And if people demanded it, it probably would happen.
Okay, any last points? Mark Barr and Terry, I've been talking the whole time. You guys want to get something in or clip? We're about end of the show here, 5:30 points.
Well, I do have one quick question. You can probably answer this pretty quickly, I think. When I was reading some of the stuff about, this is going back to the whole Mike McConnell thing, when I was reading about Mike McConnell's company and some of the stuff concerning emails and whatnot, I started to wonder, and remembering back to this minor scandal of the early Bush administration, where apparently there's some sort of law out there that says that all of the administration's emails have to go through the government servers and be logged and whatnot, and that there was some sort of external email system. And I was actually wondering if Mike McConnell's company had anything to do with that whole thing in that regard.
My understanding was that Mike McConnell's company, GovTech, was handling sensitive internal government communications, email communications in the Congress and some of the executive agencies. As to the White House email system, I think they were involved in that. I think they also may have had in his company, New Media, the political arm, he may have had some involvement with a separate account for that Karl Rove used for political communications out of the White House. My understanding is that under the law, all of these communications, no matter how they're characterized, are subject to the Secret Service oversight, and that the matter of having access to that information should be something that is protected. There's been litigation about that by an aggressive and well-funded law firm, and I don't know exactly where that stands, but that was one of the issues that about the McConnell assassination, is that he may have been assassinated because he knew where those White House communications by Rove were in the system. They
right.
had been moved out of where they were originally stored, but Connell, because he was advised that it would be illegal to destroy those communications, my belief is that he would not have destroyed them. He would have moved them to a different place so they couldn't easily be found, but if push came to shove, they could be produced. And the reason for his assassination, one possible reason for his assassination, was that they knew he would not lie about that, and that's why that they wanted him terminated.
Gary?
No, I just wanted to thank you for giving us a ray of hope at the end of this mess, because the young people, the Occupy movement, the backbone of the Occupy movement, they're basically have given up on the election system being able to fix this. It's so helplessly corrupted, hopelessly corrupted. Election, judiciary, media. And it's great to see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because the Occupy movement is nonviolent. And I guess I keep thinking back to the quotes from the founding fathers, particularly Jefferson, ballot box or cartridge box, guys.
I do have one thing to add. Cliff, do you have a couple minutes still?
Sure.
Okay, you mentioned something about military, and I also mentioned to you that Terry Bain is a military historian. Did you want to bring up that point before we leave here today?
Sure. This group, Enterprise Alabama, as I understand it, is adjacent to Fort Rucker, and Fort Rucker is the where the is it the Army Air Force or Army the air component of the Army,
the helicopters
operate out of there, and that's a major military center. And my understanding is that the there was a criminal enterprise that began back in the days of the Vietnam War, and they drew from some of the they would get some of the people leaving the Fort Rucker as one of their recruiting groups or participants. Other people with Ku Klux Klan kind of background from Alabama, and some of the people with the Nazi background. But anyway, it was a criminal enterprise that was headed. One of the principal figures was the former chief of police in Enterprise, Alabama. And but that is the, according to this tipster, was the that's the base, the criminal enterprise base of the election stealing operation that Karl Rove runs. And a guy named Mark Fuller, who is now a federal judge, was also a major stockholder in a company called DOS Aviation. And my understanding is that DOS Aviation is sort of the current or modern manifestation of this this criminal enterprise based in Enterprise, Alabama. And anyway, it's all interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about that. I'm going to follow up on that too. I'm really interested. It's really good to hear somebody with the legal background that you've got, because they tend to talk about people who try to bring these facts up as being conspiracy theories, and I've always liked to remind people that once the lawyers get into it, no, it's no longer a conspiracy theory. They can make it conspiracy charges.
Exactly.
You guys want to round it up here?
I'll give you a last point, and that is that Karl Rove on June 20th of this year was on the Greta Van Susteren show. And he went berserk.
Huh.
And if, on that day, this indictment by the public interest groups was served on his Crossroads office, as was a letter from President Obama's election attorney, Bob Bauer. And but I'm sure Rove was following this conference I talked about, which was pretty pointed at, in its criticism of Karl Rove. And interesting, the most interesting thing about this appearance is that Karl Rove attacked this woman, Dana Jill Simpson. And Greta Van Susteren was very puzzled by it, and Rachel Maddow on MSNBC later was very puzzled about it. And but this Jill Simpson is an Alabama attorney who told the story of how Rove had corrupted the Justice Department, corrupted the election process in Alabama on Siegelman, and implicated the judge who owns owned DOS Aviation. So all the people and the dynamics of the corruption of our election system were part of this attack that she made in 2007. And here's Karl Rove talking about feeling that he's being subjected to thuggish and tactics and intimidation by Jill Simpson. So it suggests that the guy realizes he's vulnerable, and there's substance to these to this line of attack.
Another ray of sunshine.
Yeah, there's always a lot of thuggishness to truth, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, sir.
Great being with you.
Hopefully
thank
we'll
you again, Cliff Arnbeck.
Thank you.
Check out, he's affiliated with freepress.org, great website here in Columbus that broadcasts to the world. Again, check us out on Occupy America Social Network. Thanks again to Terry, Mark. Anybody have any last words before I end the transmission, guys?
I'm good.
Oh, no. I guess that's it, huh? Is Terry gone?
I'm good.
Okay, I guess we're done. Brett, you can wrap it up, buddy. Thank you very much. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll be back hopefully next week with another guest, hopefully Bev Harris from Black Box Voting. We're really trying to track her down. You know what? I bet Cliff has her personal phone number. I'm going to have to ask.
Woot.
What's that?
Oh, he's still there. I say, Cliff, do you have, I was hoping you'd give, maybe you can get us in contact with Bev Harris. I'm going to have a hard time getting her.